We're going to go ahead and get started, even though people will filter in. My name is Gloria Gonzalez. I'm a senior editor at Crane Communications. I'm also the former news editor of Ecosystem Marketplace, an online news service that covers water, carbon, and biodiversity issues. And it's in that capacity that I'll be moderating today's session on endangered species. We have what will be a very lively, important, and very timely discussion given recent news developments with regard to western birds, nesting birds. This is a very important topic. Obviously, these birds are challenged in a lot of ways, and there's a variety of different approaches that are being used to try to conserve them. We're going to talk about some of those challenges, what people see as the best approaches to try to, conserve these birds. And a couple of things I want to ask you guys when we get to the Q&A, I want you to remember that this session is being recorded, so please wait till I hand you the mic. And also, please remember to identify yourself and your outlet. Also, remember that SEJ members get priority, and then we're going to leave plenty of time for Q&A, so I anticipate we will get to everybody's questions, but just remember SEJ members go first. So I just want to briefly say thank you to our panel for being here first. We're going to have a really great diversity of views here, which is fantastic for an SEJ panel. Mike is going to go ahead and get started with his presentation. I'm not going to go through their bios. We have their bios available. If you give me your contact information, I will make sure you get all that background information as well as their contact details for any follow-ups you may have. But I'll allow them to introduce themselves and briefly talk about what brings them to the SEJ conference today.
Great. Thanks, Gloria. Can everybody hear me, I hope? So I'm Michael Tabo. I'm Assistant Regional Director for Ecological Services for the Fish and Wildlife Services Mountain Prairie Region out of Denver. My principal job is to administer the Endangered Species Act for the Fish and Wildlife Service in that region, and we were the administrative lead region for the sage-grouse decision. So that's what brings me here. We're also a co-lead region with our southwest region in Albuquerque for the prairie chicken. So, and I really appreciate being here. It's been a while since I've been in front of an SEJ crowd, and so thank you for having me in here. It's always good to come and talk to you guys. So I'm just going to give you some pretty high-level context for sage-grouse and prairie chicken, and I'll leave the details to my colleagues for some of the specifics. I'll start with greater sage-grouse. There's a long history of greater sage-grouse. We've had a number of petitions under the ESA to list that species. We've had a lot of findings. We've had a lot of court decisions. We've had a lot of findings. We've had a lot of court decisions, culminating in the most recent finding on September 22nd that we announced a not warranted decision for the species and removed it from the candidate list for consideration under the Endangered Species Act. It's important to note that the greater sage grouse is an umbrella bird. It is an umbrella bird that represents a huge ecosystem. There's 173 million acres of sagebrush sea out there that the sage grouse occupies. It's home to pronghorn and sage thrashers and plants. It's a huge ecosystem, and the sage grouse represents that, and the very same impacts, the very same stressors that affect sage grouse could affect these other species. So again, it's an umbrella bird, and as we look at landscape conservation, which is what we approached on the greater sage grouse, we're looking at this entire suite of species in that context. So why did we get to where we got to on a greater sage grouse? Well, the federal planning effort was pivotal. BLM and the Forest Service, being the principal land management agencies, set up a process 3 or 4 years ago to amend 98 land use management plans. They've developed 2 environmental impact statements. They have 4 records of decision across this 173 million acres. That's what the yellow represents. They targeted their conservation. They have general habitat management areas in the light blue, which are lower density bird areas. There are priority management areas, which is where the core and the most dense birds are across the entire range, and they have more targeted conservation in those areas. They have sage-grouse focal areas, which are large federal land bases that have high density of birds that are the core, that are the most important areas for sage-grouse conservation. And these plans are scientifically based. There's LEC buffers around the breeding areas. There's density caps, there's disturbance limits, there is adaptive management controls, there's monitoring, there's triggers to modify management if those triggers are met. So there's a huge amount of science that has gone into the development of those lands management plans. And the implementation of those plans were pivotal into the future for our decision. But the federal plans were not the only game in town. There's a huge amount of state effort, private land. All 10 states developed land management plans or conservation plans for greater sage grouse. Three of them, Montana, Oregon, and Wyoming, had plans that had regulatory bases that gave us a high degree of certainty that those plans would be implemented. NRCS, which is a federal agency, has their sage grouse initiative. They've implemented millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in conservation in a greater sage grouse range. Private lands have done candidate conservation agreements with assurances. We've engaged with candidate conservation agreements with federal agencies where there's a mixed ownership land base to leverage that conservation. So there was a lot going on over the last several years which formulated the conservation framework for sage grouse. We, Fish and Wildlife Service, embarked on a very heavy science component of this. We, 2+ years ago, we engaged our collaborators on models and science that they were already developing or could develop with us. And as opposed to 2010, where we didn't have some of these tools when we made our warranted finding, we had some new capability to evaluate exposure and risk. So we had models that represented habitat distribution and population distribution, the boxes on the left. We had risk models for oil and gas and agriculture that we could overlay to make some assessments as to what that risk would look like and how it would translate into effects of the birds. So there's a lot of new science that went into that. So how did we land? Well, there's still going to be stressors for greater sage grouse on the landscape. There's still going to be impacts locally, and there's still going to be effects on local populations. But as opposed to 2010, we have a much higher degree of certainty that there are mechanisms in place to ameliorate those stresses. We believe that there's still going to be well-distributed, relatively abundant sage grouse populations across the landscape that represent the genetic diversity for the bird, and that the regulatory mechanisms, as we've evaluated them, protect at least 90% of the breeding habitat for this bird. And most of the bird and bird activity occurs within a very limited distance of the breeding area. So a lot of the habitat's going to be protected by federal and state land management planning efforts. Moving forward, implementation for the state and federal plans is going to be absolutely pivotal. Our decision relied on those plans to be implemented. They're scientifically based. The Fish and Wildlife Service is in this for the long game. We've been telling people, don't pull your foot off the gas pedal. Stay forward on implementation and implement the plans and implement the science that you've said you're going to implement through the plans, and we'll have a benefit to the sagebrush ecosystem. I'm assuming the presentation will be made available to participants.
Yes. Yeah.
So there's some contact information. We have a website that has all the findings, all the science, all the PowerPoints we ever did, all those modeling, everything's on that website. So lesser prairie chicken, a little bit different bird. We listed this species as threatened in April of 2014. The difference between a prairie chicken and a sage grouse, over 50% of the greater sage grouse land base is in federal ownership and federal control. The states manage the bird, but the federal government manages the habitat. The lesser prairie chicken has a very, very large percentage of private land base, a little bit different conservation challenge. At the time we listed in 2014, there had been a number of several years in a row where we'd had some pretty dramatic population declines. We had drought. We still had ongoing renewable energy transmission, habitat fragmentation, and grass conversion due to agriculture. So those were all threats that we evaluated. Again, very large landscape species, 5 states. The red areas here represent kind of the core focal areas of, say, of lesser prairie chicken. I've been working on sage grouse too long. Lesser prairie chicken conservation along with corridors and that, so that the whole conservation strategy is about focusing on these core areas and connectivity between the birds. There is a lot of conservation going on. We have the Lesser Prairie Chicken Initiative. which is the counterpart to the Greater Sage-Grouse Initiative that NRCS is doing, with a lot of financial assistance to private landowners given to private land base. The Waffle Rangewide Plan that Sean will talk about. Conservation Bank and private conservation efforts that you'll hear from Eric and Wayne. A lot of private landowner conservation through CCA's Conservation Reserve Program, keeping the grass up. That's what's important for Lesser Prairie Chicken. A curveball we got in early September was we had a court decision from the Western District of Texas that vacated our rule for the Lesser Prairie Chicken. We're disappointed in that, obviously. The Department of Justice filed a motion for reconsideration with that court to leave the protections of the ESA in place while we address the court's issues. That was done in late September. We don't have a ruling for that, and we don't have any kind of long-term recommendations for whether we will appeal the decision or not into the future. So that's West Texas, yeah. And that's it.
Great. Thank you, Mike. And Mike's presentation will be available on the SCJ website. I'm not sure when that will happen, but so if you need immediate access to the PowerPoint or his contact details, please see me afterwards. Sean?
Okay. My name is Sean Kyle. I'm the Industry Services Director for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. jump ship for the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. And I've been doing that since January. Prior to that, I was with Texas Parks and Wildlife, and I was the chair of the Lesser Prairie Chicken Interstate Working Group and one of the authors that developed the Lesser Prairie Chicken Range-Wide Conservation Plan. I will tell you first off that there are some very important differences between lesser chickens and greater sage-grouse, and Mike has pointed some of those out. And he mentioned that lesser chickens are in a largely private land landscape, and that it does create some very different challenges. Lesser chickens are largely on about, I think it's about 96% private land. The other really critical difference between lesser chickens and greater sage grouse is that lesser chickens are largely use a habitat that is not an old growth type of approach. It's something that can be, it's a very dynamic system that can be restored fairly easily. And in many cases, you can go from bare dirt to prairie chicken habitat in 3 to 5 years if you get some rain. So it's a completely different conservation challenge than greater sage grouse. I think it's one that we have a lot of potential for. We've been working very hard over the last couple of years, particularly on developing this conservation plan and implementing it. And we've been seeing some very good responses and some great partnerships to get conservation on the ground. And am I just doing a quick overview here?
Yes.
All right, then I'll leave that and pass it over to Eric. Did you have a question?
No, that's okay. We'll get into the question and answer after.
Great.
Okay, great. My name is Eric Holst. I'm an Associate Vice President with Environmental Defense Fund. I'm based in Sacramento, California, but I oversee EDF's wildlife work across the U.S. Just a little plug here for Sacramento. Next year's SCJ conference is in Sacramento, so please come. please come, and I'm happy to show you around if you're interested. There's no sage-grouse or prairie chicken in Sacramento, but a few sage-grouse up in the northwest part of the state, and then we have the bi-state population in the east. So our interest has been conservation of wildlife habitat on America's working lands, and we've been working on that for a good 20 years or so. Working lands defined as the lands that are producing food, fiber, and energy. Private working lands are about two-thirds of the lower 48. So if you think about that, two-thirds of our land is owned and managed by folks that are growing crops, grazing cattle, harvesting timber, things of that nature. And therefore, outcomes for wildlife are heavily dependent on the management choices of farmers and ranchers and forest landowners. And if you include public land that's managed under lease arrangements with ranchers or forest land operators. You know, I don't have a precise number, but it's, you know, probably 80%, more than 80% of the land is influenced very heavily by the management decisions of farmers and ranchers. And so, you know, the question we've been asking ourselves for years is, well, what can we do to enlist that group of folks as allies in recovering populations of wildlife throughout the U.S.? And so, you know, I think there's a legacy that maybe from the environmental community, which might be a little bit more antagonistic. The view is that the management actions of farmers and ranchers are harming wildlife. You know, I guess our view is that's certainly the case in some places, but a lot of our populations of wildlife depend on private working lands or public working lands at some point during their life cycle, and so you can either sort of force good behavior or you can incentivize good behavior, and we've kind of chosen the latter path to try to squeeze out as much conservation as possible by creating incentives for private farmers and ranchers to conserve habitat and manage the vegetation, reduce risks in ways that support species. So, you know, we got involved a few years back with, you know, and we're trying to work on sort of the biggest wildlife conservation challenges out there. We're a little bit sort of, we challenge ourselves. And so lesser prairie chicken and greater sage grouse have been sort of the two biggest deals in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years in terms of wildlife conservation. And our thought has been, if we can help develop systems that both create very high-quality conservation and create a sort of a revenue opportunity, an incentive opportunity for private farmers and ranchers, we will have created a win. And so we've been working on these two species for a number of years. The tool that we've come to is called Habitat Exchange, and I might get into it in a little bit more depth, but it's basically a mechanism for connecting buyers and sellers of conservation services. The idea is that, you know, that there are folks out there interested in conserving these species, either because out of the goodness of their heart or because they're a public agency that wants to either avoid listing or prevent get a species off the list. Or in some cases, it's private industry who has an obligation to offset their impact under either the Endangered Species Act or state requirements. Or in some cases, they also sort of out of the goodness of their heart or because they want to avoid the restrictions that come with a listing, are trying to get out ahead of a listing and conserve species. So Habitat Exchange is simply a venue to allow those who are interested in buying conservation services to connect with farmers and ranchers who are providing it. And it's governed by strict science-based standards and under the guidance of a regulatory agency. In most cases, it will be the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So I'll go into more depth about that, but the idea is that we'd like to try to implement these programs in key problematic species arenas and unlock this opportunity for farmers and ranchers to provide conservation benefits. And this is the last thing I'll say before turning it over to Wayne. One of the advantages of this is that we're operating in a hyper-political environment on ESA. There's many, many proposals in Congress to prevent listings or to overturn listing decisions. We see this as a dynamic which is completely inappropriate, right? Decisions about listing of species should be made by professionals at the Fish and Wildlife Service. So we want to, the swing vote in this sort of political environment we feel is the agriculture community. If we can enlist farmers and ranchers as allies in recovering species, we think it'll start to shift the politics of the ESA. So let me leave it at that and turn it over to Wayne.
Thanks, Eric. So good morning, Wayne Walker. Happy to be here. I've spent the last 15 years of my career in the pursuing positive outcomes in the energy and environment intersection. From about 2000 through 2012, I was a wind energy developer who developed projects in this part of the country, learned a lot about the greater prairie chicken and lesser prairie chicken, eagles and other species. I then worked for electric utility and had to deal with siting large transmission lines, wind farms, etc. So I've learned a lot about this space. I'm a conservationist and a businessman. You know, I've been exposed to all these challenges, met a lot of people, had a lot of learning moments along the way. And so these moments are instructive in the views that I'll share with you, these introductory comments and today. Overarching things I've learned about the energy and environment intersection is people dislike change and they dislike uncertainty. And the ESA space requires a lot of both. Natural resources are going to continue to lose badly if you compare them to traditional development opportunities for private landowners. There's a reason why large landscapes in this country are being fragmented and developed by a lot of threats. It's because when it comes time for landowners to make a choice, it's more profitable to sell your land to be chopped up into subdivisions or wind farms, or if you own the minerals, oil and gas, etc. So you've got to have a plan that allows the free market cost of things like prairie chicken credits and sage grouse credits and other species credits. Ideally, we evolve to a world where it's ecosystem-based versus species-based so that people can make choices and that natural resources can win. If you don't have that and people can't value those things, we're going to continue to lose our landscapes to traditional development. Finally, the last thing I learned is industry will not voluntarily pay to offset impacts on any meaningful kind of metrics for any sustained time period unless there's a regulatory instrument to effectuate needed market drivers to invest in conservation. And for industry, this is as much about, it's not just, you know, them being happy about having to incur another cost on their business model, but they need to know that there's a level playing field between what their competitors are having to pay versus what they have to pay. A few general comments about the chicken situation and the role of free markets. You know, our company and the conservation banking industry in general are committed to developing truly competitive markets. The service supports these markets through its approval of Conservation Bank, recognizing they can play a large role. Price competition in these markets will work if there's a level playing field in terms of the rules of the game, especially as to quality of conservation offsets. Equal treatment of all conservation providers, both in terms of mitigation site qualification and process review and approval, is key to ensuring effective conservation outcomes. It is important to recognize, though, that these species markets are not true mature commodity markets. We're not selling a bushel of corn here. We're not buying a gallon of gasoline. These are new markets, and they have to have a lot of certainty so people will invest with them and they'll mature to mature markets. You've got to have high standards, and this is the case for conservation banks today. You know, at-risk species are not going to be best protected by monopolies. We're seeing monopolies such under these 4D rules, as you see with the range-wide plan, where the states are basically the regulator, the administrator, and the market provider. That's not really the way that markets work. You've got to have separation of roles and responsibilities so you'll have better outcomes. The right way forward is to make people like myself, our company, and our competitors compete against other bankers in a free market. You do that by having a level playing field. You make sure the master regulator, which in this case is the Fish and Wildlife Service, keeps the goalposts, the goal lines, and the boundaries the same for everybody, including at critical milestones, and doesn't give one party an advantage over another. Because when that happens, a species loses. When the standards aren't held and the rules are modified arbitrarily, the species loses and lower standard mitigation wins the day. We provide permanent mitigation. We don't do term mitigation. Sean will talk about his program. 75% of mitigation is farm bill-like term offsets. We don't believe that model works. The rest of the program is 25% permanent. Banking standards. The standards mean a lot, and those may be a lot for y'all, but standards and details are the key to success in these markets. You know, the state plan hasn't secured a single acre of permanently protected land that's had to follow the same standards as the banks who are enticed to compete in this market. This isn't an accident. It's a result of allowing the states to decide what standards they'll follow versus requiring them to follow the standards that are clearly articulated in their plan and when the Fish and Wildlife Service listed the bird. We're hopeful the service will take advantage of the recent decision that Mike referenced to take a look at what needs to change in the state plan and what needs to change in the federal government's own rules so you can get this level playing field. You've got to have a level playing field because without that, the standards degrade. And if you have standards less than banking standards, the conservation outcomes will be predictably bad and a sad race to the bottom will happen. As bankers, we're committed to working with the states. We tried a lot to help them over the last couple of years. We're committed to working with landowners to deliver economically efficient conservation programs that contribute to the recovery of the bird. This isn't a situation without a solution. The solution is in front of us. Level the playing field, require people to follow the rules, get good conservation outcomes. It's just going to take a concerted effort to make sure the mindset prevents protection of cultures and politics. You can't have that over getting conservation accountability for outcomes. Very quickly, a summary of kind of what we've done over the last 3.5 years, believe it or not, I've been doing this 3.5 years. Our team has put together 90,000 acres of bank sites across the range of the prairie chicken. We got the first ever programmatic bank agreement, umbrella agreement approved for the Fish and Wildlife Service, which takes a very antiquated process for approving these banks and makes it very efficient. So I can add new rancher partners, all our partners are private landowners, to the model as long as they meet a set of predefined criteria instead of a sequential manner where every property takes 2 to 3 years to review. So we've got these 90,000 acres. The states have a goal of securing 100,000 acres of permanent protection over the range. One would hope that we would be talking together so we could achieve strongholds, but right now things are pretty tense relationship. We've got full approval of 30,000 acres to sell credits today, and we've done all this for a little less than $5 million, which is less than what WAFA's currently spent to get its program going and enter into third-party contracts. So I look forward to the discussion, and you know we need your help to put scrutiny on this topic. How we go forward and mitigate for these species, prairie chickens, sage grouse, monarchs, et cetera, is going to be determined on what model we use. Do we use kind of a federal government term-based taxpayer-funded program as the hub of the mitigation model? That hasn't worked. And if you look at what that model has done globally, it's got us on a path to the sixth extinction. Not a good place to be. Or do we use a model whereby the states play a large role with the federal government, but they're administrators and regulators and not also in the market so that you distort the market outcomes and lower the conservation standards? So that's all I've got. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everyone. I guess my first question will go to Sean. Sean, two parts, if you have any response to anything that was just said. And also, if you could talk a little bit about what the impact has been on the prairie chicken since the listing. Obviously, there's been an increase in the population. How much of that is related to the listing? How much of that is related to other factors at play?
Thank you. So I think the important thing here is to keep in mind that 3 years ago, there really wasn't a conservation market in the Great Plains. It was an area that had not had an endangered species issue of any substance. Most of these companies and landowners who were working in this region hadn't really had to deal with that. The range-wide plan was the state Fish and Wildlife Agency's seeing a potential train wreck coming, trying to develop a plan that would engage those private landowners and the industries in conservation efforts. And it's important to realize that before a species is listed, for the most part, most of these are the responsibility of the state Fish and Wildlife Agencies. And the number one organization out there working with private landowners in most of these states is the state Fish and Wildlife Agencies. Biologists have relationships with the private landowners, long relationships where we worked with them for decades. So this effort to put something on the ground that would conserve lesser prairie chickens, would work with landowners and industries, was never intended to push an industry that frankly didn't exist in the region out. It was trying to come up with some solutions. And that system is actually a free market system where the conservation that occurs comes in from private landowners, and we look for conservation that achieves the maximum benefit for prairie chicken habitat at the lowest price. So with that, I'll sort of, you know, I'm sure we'll come back to that issue. In terms of what we've accomplished with this in the first few years, it's really a remarkable new approach that has brought a lot of people to the table. We've brought over, I think we're at 179 companies enrolled in this, and these range from small mom and pop organizations. I've got oil and gas companies that range from two guys and their dog up to multinational corporations that are involved in this. We're proving that it can work for small companies and large companies. Those companies have enrolled about 11.5 million acres in this program, where they have committed to carry out conservation efforts on those properties and to mitigate for their impacts. In the first year, we brought in about $35 million. We're actually close to, I think we're at $43 million now in about a year and a half in terms of conservation for the lesser prairie chicken. And that money comes in the door and goes into a non-wasting endowment fund. The approach is that the interest supports conservation in perpetuity. And we built a system that measures the habitat that's impacted and the habitat that is conserved. And we have to maintain a 2-to-1 mitigation ratio. So for every acre that we impact, we look at the quality of that habitat, and we have to provide twice as much quality and habitat out there on the landscape as was impacted. So there's a net benefit from this program. What we've accomplished thus far is we put our first permanent conservation on the ground in I guess 2 months ago, and we've got over 100,000 acres under contract with farmers and ranchers to preserve, maintain, and restore habitat. A lot of the habitat that we've contracted with these farmers and ranchers for is actually carrying out restoration, where we're taking degraded habitats or converted habitats and turning them back into prairie chicken habitat. So far, it's been a wildly successful program. We are seeing increases in prairie chicken numbers over the last couple of years. A year before last, we had a 20% increase in prairie chicken numbers. This past year, we've shown another 25% increase, and we expect those numbers to continue to increase. As far as what's bringing about that population increase, precipitation definitely is one of the factors that those populations are responding to. When the listing decision occurred, we had a 50% population decline during that year that was largely due to the drought. Prairie chickens are like any other bird. If it doesn't rain, they don't breed. You can't really separate the effects of the rain and the conservation that's occurring. WAF was put quite a bit of habitat conservation on the ground, and in addition, the conservation measures have resulted in the companies changing the practices about how they develop and where they develop. That means that we're preserving more habitat through that factor as well. In addition to that, NRCS is also putting a lot of conservation efforts on the ground. The states are putting conservation efforts on the ground, and we're starting to see a turn in the tide for lesser prairie chickens. We hope to continue that, and our goal really is to focus on this on a range-wide approach. Conservation banks generally are a small-scale, relatively small-scale, individual location issue. The range-wide plan is focused on taking this battle across the entire range and recovering the species. We don't believe that that listing of a species is necessarily a good thing. That there are better ways to manage for these species than having them listed under the Endangered Species Act. And I'm not saying anything bad about U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but the act itself hasn't necessarily been that successful in recovering species. It is a regulatory process, but it's a very difficult process, and we don't tend to get to that point until the species has already declined substantially.
Mike, I was just wondering if you could respond to what Sean said and also talk a little bit about what engagement you've had with groups that were promoting or pushing for a listing since the decision was released.
So I guess I would start off with the job of the Fish and Wildlife Service is not to list species. The job of the Fish and Wildlife Service is to conserve species. And I think what we've been trying to do probably for the last decade is changing our paradigm from just put the thing on the list and regulate it to working with partners such as WAFWA. I think the incredible amount of effort that went into the Greater Sage-Grouse decision, the amount of resources the Fish and Wildlife Service brought to work with BLM, the Forest Service, the states, et cetera, to develop conservation plans, I think is indicative of the shift that the Fish and Wildlife Service is taking regarding conservation. I hope I don't have to do another sage-grouse decision anytime soon. But even on smaller species, we've done a number of programs in Utah where we've worked with the states to develop conservation programs that have headed off listings because they conserve species. That's the goal of the Endangered Species Act. And I would advocate that the Endangered Species Act has done in the Greater Sage-Grouse decision exactly what it was supposed to do, which was to bring together collaboration, partnerships, to develop a landscape-level conservation strategy that gets implemented across the range for the betterment of the species. So that's where we're headed. I agree incentive-based conservation is superior to regulation. Sometimes we can't get there, and the federal government, Fish and Wildlife Service in particular, has to make decisions to list and protect species under the Endangered Species Act. Once it gets there, it's a lot harder to work within that framework because there are some constraints and restrictions and statutes and things that we have to deal with. We have a lot more flexibility outside of that before we get to that point.
So, Gloria could respond a couple things, and then I know you want to let Eric talk and get to the audience. So, first of all, the comment that banks are not really created for landscape scale, I don't understand that logic. 90,000 acres in the best remaining prairie chicken habitat is a landscape scale solution. Okay, I think it's more about the states not wanting to pay the true compliance price that we have to charge by going through a process that they were supposed to go through but have been allowed by the leadership of the service to avoid. So they don't understand how contractually we may have to charge more. So we have to go to landowners that have birds, meet this long list, document, set of criteria, have the right habitat to serve as the anchors, the core areas. We have to go to that. And those landowners are smart. And they realize that they have a precious resource. So guess what? They get a huge share of the pie. In our model, they get half of what I sell credits for, okay? So there's, back to my point earlier, when you disconnect the standards from conservation outcomes and market pricing outcomes, the species loses and the states are then allowed to go tie up land for the permanence, of which they've only got about 1,500 acres. It's not the optimum habitat. And we have to play by a different rule book. The range-wide plan on the term side is not a free market. The costs are very detailed in the range-wide plan, what they will pay for different practices. And it's tied basically to the NRCS cost structure. That's not a free market. Eric can talk to you about what a free market is in his system. We've got increases in populations. You know, I will agree with Sean on that. You know, we've had widely swinging populations the last few years. Huge drought. arguably historical proportions, worse than the 50s. The last several months, unbelievable rains, records in many part of the range, flooding in many rivers in Oklahoma. I live in Oklahoma and in Texas. So yeah, that's been a drastic swing, and the bird responds to that. We've also had huge impact to the economy with oil. So, but you can't look at the last couple years and say that the range-wide plan had a statistically meaningful impact to the population. They've done a lot of good outreach, but you got to look, you know, these things, like any statistician will tell you, look over the last 10 or 20 years. What has a population done? Hadn't done well. Had a little blip up in the last couple years. And again, it hasn't done well with all the hundreds of millions of dollars through federal programs, CRP, NRCS, that have gone to landowners across the range. It's kept going down. So when we get back into a normal weather pattern, if that ever happens again, where we average out these extremes, it's going to be a long time before we see any impact. And I would argue these farm bill type programs aren't going to get us there. So
I definitely want to open it up to Q&A for the last, we have a little less than 30 minutes or so. I'm going to ask you to remember to identify yourselves before you ask a question, and ask you to identify yourselves before you answer.
Trip Baltz, staff correspondent with Bloomberg BNA in Denver. I covered the announcement on September 22nd of Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell. And she, and Mike, to your point, she said, not only did she say this is the most significant land use decision, this is greater sage-grouse, in the history of the United States, but she also said that this is a sign of the success of the Endangered Species Act. Now, she did say that it was used as leverage from 2010, the warranted but precluded finding up to the not warranted decision. So my question is, interestingly, right after her, one of the governors who is there, Governor Matt Mead of Wyoming, said the Endangered Species Act is a failure and we need to amend it and basically redo it. Which of those two things is true? does the act need work, or can it be used effectively as leverage to come up with this LUPA effect, land use effect, with 98 land use plans and a not listing? And I have a quick follow-up.
So my short answer is yes. I think the act has done exactly what it was meant to do in the greater sage-grouse decision. Even Dan Ash, the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, has acknowledged that if we had our druthers, there are some parts of the statute that we might want to look at. And we have almost 40 years of experience of implementing the act, and I think we do see there are improvements. I think if you sat down and talked to Governor Mead, not that I want to put words in his mouth, but it's incentive-based, working with a more collaborative upfront to conserve species. I think he would advocate that more state control regarding decisions and conservation should take place. And it's hard to get things off the list. I mean, he's got a terrible history in his state, not because of him, but because of, there are actions that the Fish and Wildlife Service believe are sufficient and adequate to recover species, and we still haven't been able to bring them over the finish line. So he's frustrated with that. So I think there are some legitimate concerns there. The position of the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service is the state wildlife agencies are our primary conservation partners, and we should be working with them a lot more and in more in-depth and relying on their expertise and capabilities in any sort of administration of the Endangered Species Act. And I think we're working on policies and procedures to help improve that, highlight that, et cetera. So I think the short answer is yes. I think it's done what it's supposed to do. I think it'll continue to do what it's supposed to do. But as anything that's been going on for 40 years, we probably learned some, and that probably has some room for improvement in some areas.
That was Mike just speaking.
Do
any of the other panelists want to weigh in?
This is Eric. And I just wanted to say, look, I don't think there would have been anywhere near the level of effort on lesser prairie chicken and greater sage grouse if you didn't have the Endangered Species Act. It's absolutely essential that the act be in place in order to stimulate, any kind of solution. Environmental Defense Fund is advocating a more collaborative incentive-based solution. But, if there's not a speed limit on the highway, everybody's going to drive over the speed limit. So,
yeah, so just a real quick example from Prairie Chicken World. These are high-level numbers I got from Sean's annual report. So you know, prairie chicken was listed in March of 14, okay? And at that point, they had 3,600,000 acres signed up. That's not a bad number on the surface. But if you compare it to what they had enrolled at the end of a year later, it went to 11,300,000. Okay, and so that kind of gives you an idea what the delta is on voluntary versus regulatory hammer. Dollars, $21 million in the program before, I think he said $45-47 million after, effectively double. So, you know, yeah, you'll get some voluntary, but last time I took a test and you got a 50 or below, that was an F. You're not going to get as much as if you have that regulatory driver in place.
And that was Wayne just talking. Sean, did you want to respond?
Yeah, just real briefly. It's really nice to take a beating for doing good things. You know, I'll totally recognize what Wayne and the others have had to say, that the Endangered Species Act is a little bit of a regulatory hammer, and not everything is a nail. One of the things about the Endangered Species Act is it does bring people to the table and foster voluntary conservation up front. We did have a major increase of folks coming into the door after the species was listed. Currently, we're in this sort of limbo, yeah, thank you, of regulatory limbo, where we don't quite know where we stand. We have kept those folks in the door and kept them doing good things for prairie chickens. They are still moving forward on this program, and they're committing to move forward and continue to conserve prairie chickens. And if you look at that decision in Midland, the decision said that it pointed out the importance of enrollment in the Lesser Prairie Chicken Range-wide plan and voluntary conservation efforts. I don't think that's going to change, but I will agree that if we didn't have an Endangered Species Act, we probably wouldn't be sitting in the same place.
And one quick follow-up. On the greater sage grouse, right away, some industry groups came forward, coal, Powder River Basin, and oil and gas interests in the West. And some of the folks said this LUPA not listing approach is worse than a listing under the Endangered Species Act. Are they just wrong?
Yes. This is Mike. You know, the conservation that's gone into the federal plans and the state plans, even the state plans that are not as regulatory as others, bring certainty to local communities. They bring a level of certainty to industry. The vast majority of oil and gas is like between 80% and 90% of the high and medium gas potential is outside of the areas that are most protected by BLM. So to the extent that there's going to be this dramatic impact on industry in greater sage grouse land, I think is false. Under an endangered species listing, and I'm not going to undermine the act because I administer the act, but there is a higher level of uncertainty there through Section 7, through project-by-project administration. I think you get far, vastly less conservation out of the fragmented application of the act across the landscape, and so I think we're in a much better conservation position and a much better certainty position. Wayne brought certainty to the table. Industry wants certainty. Local governments want certainty, and so the planning efforts and the conservation efforts that have been brought to the table that led us to our decision bring certainty to the table, and I would postulate that the litigation on those plans brings a much higher level of uncertainty as to future outcomes.
Marcia Johnston, freelancer. Wayne, you said you hoped that Midland, I guess it's Midland decision, mm-hmm. would cause Fish and Wildlife to review its plan or its decisions or something. Could you just be a little more specific what you meant, what you'd hope they would do, and maybe Mike has a response?
Yeah, this is Wayne speaking. It's Gloria, I finally got it. I finally said my name there. First, I agree with Sean. It's tough to be the one taking a beating for trying to do good things. I've taken a fair set of beatings myself over the last few years. What I meant by that is we are in limbo. Sean said we're in limbo. I agree with him on that. We're in limbo. We're in uncharted territory because the bird is technically not listed. The service has come back and said, hey, look, you know, will you why don't you keep it listed and we'll do what you want, Judge. We'll redo the, it's a complicated term piece, but you know, we'll redo the listing evaluation process, basically. You said we incorrectly interpreted the policy, give us another chance. But while you do it, leave it listed, because if you unlist it, you're creating this, what they call a whipsaw of uncertainty, because, you know, people will wonder, do they need to enroll mitigation plans? You know, are they still going to have liability for impacting habitat? You know, that's basically what's going to happen. So what I was suggesting is that, you know, look, let's use this to fix the areas where the playing field's not level relative to permanent mitigation. And if those, I would argue they really don't need to be clarified, but clearly there's some folks in the service, not including Mike, who think that they are ambiguous. Let's fix that. Let's fix the 4D rule. Let's fix the industry CCAA, and let's fix the Lesser Prairie Chicken Guidance. So if it's listed again, there is a level playing field. And I can be friends with Sean instead of have to argue with him on panels like this. I mean, we need a level playing field. That's all I'm looking for here.
My name is Judith Joy. I work at a newspaper in Southern Illinois, but for many years I was secretary of the Illinois Prairie Chicken Foundation. I was just interested in knowing, when you are restoring chicken habitat, what species of grass do you plant, and is burning part of your management program?
A great question. I always like to talk about grass. The Lesser Prairie Chicken Range-wide plan kind of identifies seven key species for prairie chicken habitat. It's a fairly simple system. So there are a lot of other things that come along with those seven species when you create the habitat, but there are a couple of shrub species that are important in that region, shin oak and sand sage. We don't generally plant those. Those tend to come in on their own. But we'll come back and stabilize that soil by planting native grasses, things like little bluestem, which are some of the taller grasses. Let's see, there's Indian grass. Side-oats grandma is another important one. And side-oats grandma?
It's a type of grass.
It's a species of grass. She's asking, what species do we plant? So it is all native. And when we get a property enrolled in the plan, we develop a management plan that manages not only things like grazing, but also prescribed fire, control of trees. Trees are a big problem for prairie chickens. If you've got invading mesquite or cedar or other species, they'll avoid those. So we work with those landowners to develop a management plan. This makes for great prairie chicken habitat and good ranching habitat as well. So a productive place where they're gonna pull off quite a bit of pounds per off the, you know, pounds of beef. So it's not gonna affect their bottom dollar.
The prairie chickens in Illinois did very well pre-World War I when farmers planted red top. And the reason they planted red top was for the dye. It was a forage, you know, make hay out of it, but they also grew red top for the dye. Then the Germans invented synthetic aniline dyes, and farmers quit growing red top, and then the prairie chicken population crashed.
Well, there we get that a lot out in Lesser Prairie Chicken country as well, where people say that when we had a lot more small grains, we had a lot more prairie chickens. And really, there's a whole lot of different things going on in that system. One, they need sort of a large landscape. So a little bit of cropland within an area can be beneficial for them if it's the right type of crops. In fact, that fragmentation can go up close to 50% in many cases, and we can still have healthy populations. The key is, what's the remainder out there on the landscape? And you have to have healthy grasslands that have the right cover. You have to have no trees, few other types of development. And I think some of those other things were things that in Illinois were starting to really get underway. There was a lot of country that was plowed out during that time, particularly after the wars. People came back, plowed a lot of stuff out. People who build houses tend to plant trees. They planted a lot of windbreaks during that time. So there were a whole lot of other issues as well. But, you know, a little bit of farming isn't bad for prairie chickens.
That was Sean in the follow-up.
Jane Braxton Little, I freelance from Northeastern California, and it's a question for Sean or anyone. Could you talk more specifically about the contracts, the instruments that you're using to bring landowners into contract?
I can, yes. I'm the industry services director, so I work mostly with the companies, and I work with them on compliance and enrollment. We have another person who handles that. I can speak to some of the contracts. The range-wide plan uses the same standards and specifications, for the most part, that NRCS uses. And those processes were approved through the NRCS conferencing report with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're also the same standards and specifications that Fish and Wildlife Service's own partners program uses. So what creates prairie chicken habitat isn't really a question. You know, we know that they don't like trees, that they need to have some residual cover, that they need to have the right species, they need to have taller cover. So those plans are developed on an individual basis with the landowner. We know what we need to do for prairie chickens. Some of the things that we do over and above the NRCS standards and specs are that we reduce the stocking rates, the number of cows that the landowners stock on that landscape. NRCS shoots for about a 50% utilization, which means the cows, the grasshoppers, and everything else take about 50% of what grows in a given year. WAFWA reduces that to about a third. We take about a third of the total. We allow them to take about a third of the total. And that grazing has a lot of beneficial results for prairie chickens. It means that you get more weeds, little important broadleaf plants that create good brood habitat for lesser prairie chickens. We also work with those landowners on trying to set up prescribed burning programs. We work with them to address any outstanding exotic vegetation issues where needed. Some of those issues are dealt with spraying of herbicides. These are not herbicides that you go out and broadcast and kill everything. They're very targeted approaches to get positive results for prairie chicken habitat.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Avery McGaha, and I am a journalist and grad student at the University of Colorado Boulder, and this is a question for Eric. I'm wondering if you can talk about maybe some of the hopeful trends or things about these programs between the public and the private sector, the gentleman to your left and right, and things that make you hopeful about the future of conservation in general and maybe even in the context of these animals.
Super, thanks. Yeah, so this is Eric. You know, I think a lot of what's demonstrated in the sage-grouse decision is that early action to conserve and then early action to develop conservation agreements that would then be implemented over time holds the potential to keep species off the list. An Environmental Defense Fund does not consider a listing to be a success. It's really an indicator that populations have declined and that threats are so great that a species is not likely to recover on its own. So there's a need to, so we sort of view that early action as being really significant. And what I think is needed, and I think Wayne has said this, is that unfortunately we're in a case where the Fish and Wildlife Service, it has a tough job. Mike has one of the toughest jobs out there. To the extent that it's able to create very precise, clear standards for what is going to help avoid listing, we're all better off. It allows people like Wayne to then go out and get investment from the private sector to do the good thing that he's doing. When you have a sort of standards that are somewhat variable so that you can achieve this sort of avoided listing or some kind of regulatory approval, you know, using path A or path B or path C, it creates confusion, and it makes it difficult for the private sector, whether it be sort of the commercial private sector like Wayne or the nonprofit sector like ourselves, to operate, or even the government agencies trying to sort of do what they do. So I have a lot of hope. I think this sage-grouse decision is the path forward. I think one of the products that was produced by Michael's agency during the sage-grouse process, I would commend it to everybody. Just Google it. It's called the Greater Sage-Grouse Mitigation Framework. It's one of the best publications the Fish and Wildlife Service has ever done, in my humble opinion. It was done by staff in Region 6. It laid out in fairly brief fashion, about 35 or 40 pages, the standards that the Fish and Wildlife Service was looking for in order to meet the requirements of the Fish and Wildlife Service to mitigate impacts. So just to be specific, mitigation is a term that it's embedded in the Endangered Species Act. The requirement is to fully mitigate and minimize impacts if there are going to be impacts permitted. And mitigation requires that you go through a sequence. It requires that if you're an energy company going to impact habitat, you would avoid impacts if at all possible, minimize the impacts that you do have, and then at the end of that avoidance and minimization, there's a residual impact that you quantify that impact and that you offset that impact. It's a fairly straightforward mechanism. So the sage-grouse mitigation framework lays out very precisely how that's going to happen. So I would suggest that it's tools like that unlock the opportunity in the sage-grouse case. My own personal experience in the lesser prairie chicken listing decision, it was a lot less certain for folks like us of what the blueprint was for following that. So I think this greater sage-grouse mitigation framework laid out, whether you're going to do it through a public sector type of a conservation or a private sector market-based conservation, that was the rules of the game. So I would say that's the way to do this.
So my kind of general response to your question, and thanks for asking, this is Wayne again. You know, one of the reasons we get to these kind of cliffhanger moments on ESA is we don't value ecosystem services broadly until we get to a point where a species is in trouble, or a stream or a wetland's in trouble, and maybe in the future, you know, we do something with carbon with landowners. So you have all this development occurring, energy, residential, commercial development, and you know, in most states of the country, with the exception of maybe California, there's no recognition that you lost an acre of something. It may be an acre of very productive habitat for a species. It may have been an acre of dirt, but that acre of dirt had some value in terms of contributing to watershed, not much. It could have been an acre of grassland, forest, whatever. They just get bulldozed, right? And so you have these kind of federal laws, you know, Clean Water Act, ESA, et cetera, that are like the backstops. But by the time you're there, man, you've lost a lot, and it's going to create really uncomfortable change for someone depending on how that decision comes out. So we've got to find a way to be more proactive in realizing the value of every acre, not just the most precious acre that harbors a chicken or a sage grouse or whatever it is. In terms of solutions, you know, my family does a lot of work with the government on our ranch, cost share programs. You know, you heard my kind of lessons learned from my journey of life earlier. You know, I'm not just saying free market is the way to go because I'm invested in it. I really think that you're not going to get those meaningful liquidity events to landowners to have systemic, sustainable change. Just paying someone a few bucks an acre to do something for a few years, that's a least cost, lowest conservation outcome approach. It's got to be maybe not life changing, but they got to be able to help pay off their land, go buy more land, which they'll then manage that appropriately. That's not happening with these government models.
So I'll respond to that and try to add a little to your question. And I'll start off by saying a bit ago I used that phrase. You know, if you're a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. And I'll say that, you know, I'm guilty of that as well, that I'm a wildlife biologist. I don't start off these questions about how do I build a market. I start off with how do I conserve lesser prairie chickens? how do I get the landowners that are out there that have the habitat to do the right things? And that's really the approach that we took when we developed the range-wide plan. I will tell you, though, that there are some definite market differences between the approaches that Wayne's talking about that actually I think we have more in common somewhat with the habitat credit exchange approach than we do with banking, in that it's a different approach for the landowners. Landowners in the Southern Plains are used to dealing with a very dynamic system, that one year will be a horrible drought, the next year will be floods. They get, you know, all their money one year, they get don't get anything the next. And when we built this system of mitigation, we took that into consideration and we said, you know, what we heard from the landowners was, we want something that's consistent from year to year. Banking tends to pay people up front. It's that feast or famine approach where they get 50% of that. Wayne mentioned 50% of that money up front. I don't know necessarily what the other 50% goes to. In our approach, they get 83.5%, and the rest of it goes to monitoring the land over time to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do. So there are some differences in that approach. I think we built this by talking to landowners, and by, I think that's the important thing when you're working on private land conservation, is engage those people. Ask them what they want. Don't ignore it. Because if you ignore it, they're not going to come to the table.
So we have about 3 minutes left. So if one more question.
Hi, thanks so much. I'll try to be short. It's Susan Moran, freelance journalist in Colorado. Maybe if either of you, maybe Eric or Wayne, could walk us through, like, how tough was it to get liquidity in a market, whether it was the bank or a habitat exchange? And kind of what are the key barriers to doing that? Because without liquidity, you have no market, right? So there's got to be enough incentive to get there.
Yeah, sorry, me start.
I'll start. I said we're actually in the case of the Habitat Exchange, we're illiquid right now. We haven't gotten the kind of certainty from the service that is going to be required to create that market signal. So that process, in the case of the Greater Sagegrass, it's under review right now. And so the service goes through a methodical process to ensure that any tool that's proposed to it meets the standards that they operate under. In this case, in the case of the sage grouse, it's not a listed species, so it's the standards that are going to help, I think, secure this not warranted decision over the long term. So they're looking at that. In the case of the Bureau of Land Management, which is looking at developing mitigation tools as well, they're going to be presumably working together with the service to create those, the standard, the review, and then the sort of certain seal of approval that a tool like a habitat exchange would meet their standards. And so once that seal of approval is granted, whatever form it takes, I think that's going to unlock the market and create sort of the liquidity in the market. Well, what's in stake for the Habitat Exchange right now is the sage grouse. Colorado and Nevada have developed habitat exchanges. There's a proposal in Wyoming. There is a lesser prairie chicken habitat exchange, but it's kind of in limbo, just like the rest of us, because of the listing conundrum.
This Wayne, great question, and obviously I believe you've got to get liquidity in the market if you're going to really affect these conservation outcomes. The short answer for prairie chicken and conservation banks is it's not a liquid market right now. As I've talked about earlier, you know, we've invested several million dollars. We were enticed to invest that money as possible partners by both the states, the federal government, under a set of rules. And last March, there was a key regulatory deadline. States didn't have anything. You know, that would be the point where you would think they'd want to partner with the private sector to buy the credits under the same standards both parties were to meet, but that's not what happened. Washington, the director in particular, lowered the goalpost and moved out the goal line to give the states more time. So at that point, the market was destroyed. And of course, there's no market driver now. There's no listing decision. This is why I'm advocating let's fix these things during the interim period so that there will be an opportunity for the market to make some money. I do want to share a success story, though. I mean, as bad as the prairie chicken situation is, you know, we have had success with other species. And the reason we've had success is because you have a situation where the industry goes through a master permitting cycle called typically a habitat conservation plan. The mitigation providers go through the banking process, and then there's a market, and everybody lives with the same standards, and those standards are enforced equally across the industry and the bankers. And we're doing that right here in Oklahoma with the American burrowing beetle, and it's been done successfully in other parts of the country. So it can work, but when you let the politics insert a new, basically, bureaucracy in the middle that controls all sides of the market and gets to determine the rules and the standards on its own accord, it doesn't work.
This is Sean. I'm going to respond to that.
Quickly.
Very briefly and say that where I grew up, that would be referred to as a manure spreader. There has not been any changes to the range-wide plan other than us increasing what we committed to do for permanent conservation. So this whole concept of the politics changing what is in the range-wide plan is patently false.
I've got letters to show you if you want.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut this off, else Jay is going to come after me. So just a couple housekeeping notes. The lunchtime plenary will start at noon. Please make your way there. If you have any follow-up questions, our panelists will be around for a few minutes. If you do write any stories about this session, please make sure you email them to me and to Cindy McDonald so we can make sure that they're on the SCJ website. And I would just like you to all join me in thanking our panelists for a terrific discussion.